everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And our good movie this week is Dead Man, directed in 1995 by Jim Jarmusch. And our bad movie is The Net, also came out in 95, starring Sandra Bullock. And we're going to start off with Dead Man. So this was the first time I'd seen this. You'd seen it before. I recall reading your review on the Stop Button. And I think it opens with you commenting how it's one of the few sort of Western films to feature Native Americans prominently. And that's certainly true. I thought it was kind of amusing to see Johnny Depp in a role where I have this theory that Johnny Depp doesn't accept parts unless he gets to see the costume design for his character first. And it has to be weird. It has to be weird enough in some way. He's like, you know, I want to put on a funny costume, you know. But this might have been, well, this might sort, you know, this was like a year after Ed Wood, and it was, I guess it was sort of at the point where like a weird costume would be enough to get him to do a movie. He didn't necessarily have to be playing a weird guy, but anybody could have played this part, essentially, because it's an everyman part, and he just sort of observes the strange going-ons around him. He's very passive. The movie is something that happens to him. It's not something that he sort of goes through. But I was wondering about why it was in black and white also as I was watching it. I was thinking, like, well, you know, is this intended to convey a sense of time because it's in the Old West? And, you know, maybe sepia tone would have been better for that, like those old Civil War photographs you see. And then I remembered, oh, it's Jim Jarmusch. He does every movie in black and white. That's just his style. It's just his thing.
Yeah, he also,
not necessarily every movie. Like Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai was in color, but Coffee and Cigarettes, and actually maybe not. Okay, but he likes black and white. It's not like this is his only black and white movie. That's just something he does on occasion. And I guess for this film, he thought it would help convey the sense of time. The cast is really remarkable. It's remarkably eclectic, and some of the interesting actors aren't even in it for more than a scene. Like Iggy Pop and Ron Perlman are both in one scene together, and it's very short, and they die. Others like Crispin Glover are only in one scene, but his is like a very prominent. It's a very featured scene. Like he has a monologue essentially, and it's the first scene in the movie. Robert Mitchum is in it, mm-hmm. and he gets a special credit in the opening as like special appearance by, but it's a little bit more than a special appearance. I mean, it's like two different scenes, and they're, you know, decent length scenes. He's, you know, Crispin Glover has less screen time, but Robert Mitchum being Mitchum, he gets the special appearance credit. And then it has some people who weren't yet really famous, like Gabriel Byrne, who, you know, the usual suspects had came out the year before this, so he was just starting to get big, but Gabriel Byrne is, who is he? He's only in one scene. He gets killed. A lot of people get shot in this movie. It's sort of period accurate to the Old West in that, you know, getting shot is just sort of something that can happen to you in your everyday life, and you gotta watch out for it. You gotta carry a piece. And when it happens, it's not very dramatic. It's like people just kind of get murdered casually, as they did back then. But yeah, I mean, you know, some actors like Gabriel Byrne, they've only got one scene because they get shot. John Hurt he's a one scene actor in this, and his scene is really good. He has a really cool part. And, you know, basically the only two real supporting roles besides Depp in terms of screen time are Depp is on the run. He gets framed for, not framed by anybody, but sort of by accident. He's, He gets the blame for a couple of murders. One of whose is Gabriel Byrnes. And he has to go on the run on the lam. And while he's on the lam, he meets this Native American who, because Depp is wounded, this Native American has decided that he's a dead man, hence the title. And he's going to help escort him on the lam on a journey to the ocean, basically, where he can sort of give him his final cast off. That's not immediately clear, but you do sort of know that he, you know, he's decided that he's dead, so he's got to accompany him. And the other major role is there's a trio of bounty hunters who are hired by Mitchum in Mitchum's second scene, and one of the bounty hunters ends up murdering the other two and actually eating one of them. And he doesn't really have any role, any lines, I mean. But he's the other kind of major character in terms of screen time, and he's played by Lance Henriksen, and kind of a barely recognizable Lance Henriksen. There's not too many movies with Lance Henriksen in them where you don't. I think the most distinctive thing about Lance Henriksen, aside from his face, is probably his hairline. He has sort of a really distinctive hairline. Peter Weller has one too. Something about like the shape of their forehead and the top of their skull, it's memorable. But anyways, he's wearing a cowboy hat through it. I probably wouldn't have noticed that it was Lance Henriksen if I hadn't read the credits. But
Henriksen, this has got to be, in a way, his most mainstream. Not really mainstream, but it's... trying to think of how to describe it. It's the only time he's ever been in a... Because, I mean, Dead Man was a Miramax... Well, I'll get to that in a bit, but it's a very weird role for him. He's not used like this in anything else. I mean, Henriksen now only does direct-to-video crap. Like, nobody ever really exploited him at the height of his popularity. He was sort of a genre actor.
Yeah, only James Cameron.
Yeah. And so this Dead Man's like the only one that does it. But there's a little bit more of that, but I'll get to that in a second. So continue.
Oh, well, I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I wasn't totally sure if I would, but because I'm not particularly fond of I liked Ghost Dog a lot, and I saw that when I was a kid. I had a even shorter attention span than I do now, so I know it must have been really good. And that's kind of what Dead Man is like. It's very slow paced, but in terms of the story, but something, there's either a very compelling performance or something sort of unexpected in every scene, as slow as it is, and it's like an hour and 50 minutes. But a lot of the cool scenes that sort of move it along, even though it's so slow paced, are due to all the interesting actors that Jarmusch casts for these single scenes. And another one that who wasn't really famous at the time was Alfred Molina, who has a really cool scene where he's apparently a priest and also of a trading post, and just like so many others, he gets shot at the end of his scene. So a lot of these characters get a great exit. They get to be killed and die. And they say every actor loves to do a death scene. So this must have been a real actor's delight for everyone. But I mean, really, right from the beginning, where Crispin Glover sort of shows up and starts talking to Johnny Depp in his strange Crispin Glover manner, it's you're in for something good, because he's all full of doom and foreboding. He's like a doomsayer who basically tells Johnny Depp, you know, he says you're just as likely to find your death in this town where he's been promised a job. And sure enough, also in some foreshadowing for the second time you watch it, he starts talking about how they're in a train car and they're watching the scenery pass by, and he says, sort of seemingly out of nowhere, he says, isn't this just like when you're in the canoe and it feels like the world is moving past you, but your canoe is laying still? Something like that.
Yeah.
So, nice bit of foreshadowing there.
And I'm,
subliminal foreshadowing.
And I'm never sure. I mean, I've probably seen it, you know, 5 or 6 times at this point. And I'm never sure, because he goes on to talk about the room that you're in while you're in the canoe. And I'm never sure if it's just Jarmusch That's kind of the thing, is that he, Jarmusch, is, people like him, he's sort of, he's not really popular enough to be like indie hipster. Like, that's kind of the thing, is that I heard that about this movie, that everybody loved it when it came out. The film people that I knew at the time really loved it when it came out. And, you know, over the years, they'd be like, well, it would have been great if the Weinsteins hadn't ruined it. And it's like, well, okay, whatever. Huh? Yeah, exactly. And it's like,
did they cut out an hour or something?
That's kind of the thing. And I mean, yes, it's Jarmusch's biggest sort of cast in a way. Like, everybody, Michael Wincott's in it, coming off The Crow. It's a very kind of Miramax-y cast in some ways. Not Gary Farmer and Johnny Depp, really, but some of the other people, sure, those are. But I can't believe that he would have wanted anybody but Michael Wincott as that one particular role of the talkative bounty hunter. I mean, because he's just perfect in it. And so, I really don't think that he.
What did people say that Miramax ruined about it?
It was very not specific, and it was just that Miramax ruined it, and Jarmusch hated working for him, which is probably true. He hated working for him, but I really don't see anything wrong. I mean, I think he's made some other really good stuff, but I don't think he's perfect by any means. So, I mean, I think that even if he had problems with this one, it still turned out. I think it's definitely his best film. I mean, by far, just because it's so kind of. What did he make? He made Ghost Dog after this, so, and then he has Limits Control's awful. Broken Flowers has tons of problems, and, you know, it's just Bill Murray trying to get another Oscar. And he made some other really good stuff, but, you know, I didn't like Down by Law, so it's kind of like I'm not really on the total Jarmusch boat, but. You know, I think he's a lot simpler, and I think I say this in my stop button post, that he's a lot simpler than people seem to think, that you don't have to read all this stuff into it, that sometimes he just does cool stuff. And in this one, it's really clear, because Johnny Depp and Gary Farmer, they just have cool scenes sometimes together because they're funny, and it's a really wacky buddy movie in times.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, when Gary Farmer is the Native American, and when Johnny Depp winds up with him, Gary Farmer becomes the star of the movie, because Johnny Depp barely says a word, and Gary Farmer is just dispensing all kinds of Indian mysticism, and he keeps calling him a stupid white man, which is funny.
Until he finds out that his name's William Blake, and then it's this really interesting idea that if you have the same name as someone, why don't you remember the stuff you did when you were that person? And that's never really that specific. Nobody talks about it once, and it sets this really nice texture to the movie, and you can't tell if he knows. He's got to know it's not the same William Blake, because they show a flashback of nobody looking at a picture of William Blake.
Nobody is the Native American's name.
Yeah, and so it's just very, there's just really cool
name,
stuff like
the name
that.
Depp gives him, rather. Yeah, I love that flashback he has where you hear his story about how he was of mixed tribes for parents, so he was ostracized from his fellow natives, and then he was taken to England and educated there, so he's encountered racism from both the white man and from the natives. Although they seem all right with him when he finally brings Depp back to his village at the end.
What I found interesting, I just was Googling it up, and Wikipedia says that it's a twisted version of the Old West, and you just mentioned that it's a realistic version of the Old West, and that's what I always thought about it too, is it's a non-sensationalized version of, you know, just how miserable it would have been. Like, I mean, this just, because I mean, just watching it at some point, every time I'm like, wow, how many days has it been since Johnny Depp bathed? Like, how many months has it been since he bathed? Like, a month.
Well, that's slightly idealized movie fantasy, that he's not really as filthy as he should be. But in fact, a lot of the actors aren't as filthy as they probably should be. But no, there's little touches that make it, you know, I've never seen Deadwood, but people always say it's such a great, you know, period realistic Western show, but there's little details in Dead Man that seem very well researched, like when Depp arrives at this town called Machine to meet Robert Mitchum for his job that he's not going to get. He sees a cowboy getting a blowjob in the street,
mm-hmm.
and then when he looks at him too long, the cowboy aims his gun at him.
But I mean, as opposed to the Clint Eastwood movie where it would have been a prostitute, the woman was at gunpoint from the cowboy. And I mean, that's the other thing, is it's not really set in the, I think I called it a Pacific Northwestern, because it's not set in a you know, the traditional Texas desert environment. I think on Depp's train ride, it's sort of an impossible train ride from Cleveland that you would see all that landscape, but
yeah.
And then the town itself is just this miserable.
Yeah. You only see it in one scene, but it's a very nice exterior set in terms of being just grimy and everything. The black and white really helps there too. It's like how black and white helped Victorian London look so awful in The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
Also featuring John Hurt.
And yeah, the small roles, because the movie really at a certain point becomes all about Depp, Farmer, and the three bounty hunters, and whoever they encounter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the little scene with Iggy Pop and Billy Bob Thornton and the other guy, and it's just a. I'm trying to think if. Okay, so they meet those guys, and then at a certain point, everybody you meet just dies. Once Depp sort of becomes.
Yeah, now that I think about it, everybody dies in the movie eventually.
Everybody dies in the movie eventually,
except for John Hurt and Robert Mitch.
Yep, everybody else I think dies, and there's this whole point where nobody wants Johnny Depp's character to start killing white men, and.
I had to remember that nobody was a character just then.
Well, it's easier than saying what Exhibiche being. Okay, Gary yeah. Farmer wants to. He wants Johnny Depp to start killing white men. And it's not really ever mentioned that it's not like an actual plot point that Gary Farmer really actually wants him to start becoming a killer of white men. And so the scene where he does become a killer of white men. It might be the most traditional Western moment in the movie because he tosses off
a line before he kills him.
He tosses off a line and he just kills these guys. And it's not like Unforgiven where they actually take the whole scene of I always wanted to be a gunfighter and I just killed somebody and I feel like living shit. It's He just does it in a very passive. So I mean, you know, Depp's passive through the whole thing, and even killing these guys in this really filmic, cool shootout scene, which kind of gets less cool when Depp has to shoot the guy that's still alive, which is another one of those realistic moments of, yeah, you're not going to kill somebody at this point. I mean, even the first scene where he shoots Gabriel Byrne. There's so much humor in the movie that you gotta kind of see it. Because I was thinking that last night when I was watching it, I'm like, we're not gonna be able to list all the humorous moments, but when he shoots Gabriel Byrne, he misses twice. And the whole time, Gabriel Byrne's just staring at him like,
yeah, he's just
never,
staring
he's
at
never
him.
Gonna hit
he's,
me.
He's like waiting for it. He's not reacting at all.
But,
yeah, there's, yeah. Yeah, it's just sort of the, you know, I love the attitude that everyone in this movie has about death, which is that it's just a part of life, and, you know, life was cheaper back then, so death didn't come as much of a surprise. There's also a scene where the three bounty hunters, Lance Henriksen kills one of them in the back of the head, and Michael Wincott is just like, oh, damn, man, why'd you have to do that? Oh, well.
Yeah.
It just happens.
And then the funny thing is, it's never clear why Lance Henriksen kills Michael Wincott. It's never been clear to me. I mean, yes, he's annoying.
Well, at that point we know that the bounty has gone public, and it's not just these three. And also the bounty has gone up because Depp's killed a few more people, so he probably just doesn't want to share the stakes anymore.
He's also
a murderous cannibal, which
That's
is
true.
Like he it's another funny horrible thing in the movie. You see him eating the remains of his arm, and that was another period thing where I was like, you know what, cannibalism probably wasn't as much of a big deal back then.
And then I was saying that too with the three, with Iggy Pop and Billy Bob Thornton and the other guy. It's like, at what point are they going to eat one of these guys?
Yeah, there's the they start talking about what they're, you know, who gets Depp, who gets to get him, and it, you know, it's possible that they're just talking about, you know, what's on him, but there's also the implication. I don't remember if it's before or after Michael Wincott gets eaten, but there is sort of the implication that they could be talking about cannibalism because Iggy Pop is in a dress, so you know that they're a little bit crazy.
And well, the crack that Wincott makes right before you hear Lance Henriksen shoot him off screen is, where are you from? It seems like you're German, which I mean, yes, okay, so he could have been, there were the Hessian mercenaries during the American Revolution, but that's one of those lines that, you know, it's funny to a modern audience. I'm not too sure that it would have been historically accurate. Because Wincott, pretty much everything he says is hilarious. I mean, I think it's, you know, Wincott's one of those guys who I don't think anybody's ever appreciated. And I don't think anybody's ever really used him, except maybe in this and partially in some other roles. Because, I mean, he's kind of looks... He's got that voice. He's kind of looks like he could be a leading man, almost. He looks like somebody who would have a huge comeback on TV or something, and he never has. But, I mean, Deadman doesn't sort of use his pretty boy good looks. He's in, you know, long hair, got a cute, he might even have a fake nose on, and he's just funny the whole time. And it's
I was just thinking about how he almost looks a little like Ron Perlman, and then I see here that he was in Alien Resurrection along with Ron Perlman.
He dies first in Alien Resurrection, which is always like the most disappointing thing about the movie, is that he gets the Anne Michael Wincott credit.
And he was also in the Canadian slasher from 1983, Curtains, which I've been meaning to see.
Yeah. And he was also in the Three Musketeers remake. Ooh, that's a good one. But
he has a very funny scene in Dead Man with a teddy bear.
Oh, that is so funny.
Which I think would date the movie at the turn of the century, because the teddy bear was invented by Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah. It's never, they never talk about when it actually takes place.
No, it doesn't really matter at all. I mean, you can sort of guess, like, one of the bounty hunters is black, so you figure it has to be about, you know, 20 or so years after the Civil War. Basically turn of the century, but it doesn't matter, so. Oh, and also Crispin Glover mentions the government's statistics on Buffalo shooting, which was a major event of the Old West. People in the train car at the beginning start shooting at Buffalo out the window.
What's interesting?
That's the thing, is that in addition to the, you know, the little details of how life was, there's also little historical details that that make it feel real.
Yeah, and the thing about that I like so much is that even with when they talk about the Native Americans and the stuff that's going on with that, and even Alfred, there's the great scene of it because
they mention the smallpox blankets.
Did you notice Lance Henriksen had one?
No.
Yeah, he leaves with a smallpox blanket, and I don't know where that was. Harvey Weinstein probably ruined that scene, that he eventually would have succumbed to smallpox anyway. But anyway, well, except that the blankets didn't actually carry smallpox, which, you know, Jarmusch would have definitely known in 95 writing this thing. But anyway, the Molina scene is just this. He's this absurdly obnoxious evangelical Christian out there. Mm-hmm. Until the Native American comes in, and then he just gets really hostile. And I mean, it's just it's kind of like Ghost Dog in that, for a movie that doesn't want to be sort of viscerally pleasing in its action sequences,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, that really doesn't fit the motif that it's cool the way somebody kills somebody in a Jim Jarmusch movie. It's really cool the way every single one.
Probably, actually probably a little bit more cinematic and cool on purpose than the murder of the two sheriffs, who are the first two people that Depp kills. But yeah, because not only does he tosses off an even more so kind of action movie line when he kills Alfred Molina, and also Alfred Molina is such a jerk that you don't feel like Depp is a horrible person for killing this guy.
The two sheriffs are just idiots. I mean, they're just, one of them's an idiot, and they were going to shoot him. There's some conflict to that, but no, I mean, the Alfred Molina scene, it's just, and then it turns into a huge shootout with Depp sort of walking around getting shot at, and he has a really funny line about how he's become a magnet for white man's metal, and it's just this. The movie retains that Depp's character is still totally out of place there and sort of moving through this very harsh landscape. And that's in the opening, you see that foreshadowed before Crispin Glover sits down on the train. The passengers on the train go from being, you know, friendly homesteaders to just these, you know, people
grizzled
that
traders and
right.
trappers,
I mean,
and stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not the train you'd want to be on. You know, it's just
with scary, imposing fur hats.
Yeah, and so the other thing, it's almost like you can't even imagine. The thing that I always wonder is, how did that Mr. Olofsson handle it in the town of Machine? The guy, because that's, so the story
is Mr. Olofsson.
Mr. Olofsson's the accountant who gets Depp's job. So basically the idea is that Depp was hired 2 months ago by John Hurt to work at Robert Mitchum's company. And because he showed up in 2 months instead of 1 month, he didn't get the job. And the thing about Depp's character is, if there had been something in the letter about there being a deadline for when you had to show up by, you know, he would have been there in time. So it's kind of like, just thinking about it like that, you know that Hurt and Mitchum, well, at least Hurt. I mean, Mitchum's just sort of this odd force in the movie. I mean, the character he plays is nothing like any of his Western characters. It's sort of like,
he's sort of like John Huston in Chinatown.
Yeah.
With a shotgun.
Every time he's got the shotgun and cigar, he's in front of the painting of him with the shotgun and cigar. And I mean, that's that painting. I wish I had that for my wall. I mean,
wow,
awesome.
Where is that? I hope it's in Jarmusch's house. I hope it's safe.
Or at least the Mitchum family got it, because it's just, it's...
Yeah.
it's kind of weird, because it's Robert Mitchum, and it was his final role. It's Mitchum in this role as a movie icon, playing something that he never really has played before. I mean, it's the equivalent of if, you know, we just did Batman, so let's say instead of Jack Palance playing the heavy mob guy, if you'd had James Garner playing Grissom in Batman.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't fit really with the motif of or Donald Sutherland. Somebody like that. It really does not fit what the guy did with his career. I mean, yes, Robert Mitchum was in tons of Westerns. Nothing, I mean, not like this role. I mean, this is the...
Well, he doesn't play too many, like, doddering, you know, he never played... He played crazy characters like Night of the Hunter, but he didn't play, like, senile crazy characters like this guy is.
Yeah. So, and then, okay, so continuing on to this town, you have the replacement, who's this Swedish guy, Mr. Olofsson, and he's a dipshit, but whatever. And then Depp goes out, and he wants to get drunk. He's out of money. His life's over. And all I can think in that scene, before he runs into the girl, is how does Mr. Olofsson function around all these guys? Like, they're really gonna not give him a good time either. I mean, he's not like any more. He doesn't fit in any more than Depp does. And then there's the very interesting the scene with the girl who's played by Millie. What's her last name?
Avital.
Avital, who was Miramax was trying to import at the time. She's a famous Israeli actress, and they were trying to import her to be one of their in their stable of, you know,
yeah,
of girls.
Miramax, the Miramax
girls. You know, she could have been. She was in. I think she was in something hilarious. Like, yes, she was in the one of the movies with David Schwimmer and Jason Lee. I mean, just like, you know, something absurd like that. But she actually got her start in U.S. film in Stargate. So when I saw Dead Man, I was like, oh, yeah, it's the girl. It's like I had to remember that I saw Stargate, you know, when I was 15 or whatever. And I was like, yeah. But she's not a prostitute in this town. So somehow that's how weird it is that when you sit and think about what Jarmusch has set up, sort of the landscape for Depp to go through is, it's a town where women can function in this harsh environment without having to be prostitutes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to some degree, yes, she was the fiance of Gabriel Byrne for a while.
Yeah, the son of Mitchum.
But, you know, it's not like she had to be a prostitute in that town, which is totally different from a lot of other westerns.
Did a cartoon cat just creep through your room?
That was actually the timer for our 30 minutes that are up for Dead Man.
Oh, well, all right then. Yeah, Dead Man. Everybody should see it.
Yes, go see Dead Man. It's
very good.
Now, did you know that The Net was also from 95? Or wait, did we pick The Net first?
Well, we didn't plan that out. Initially, we picked The Net in honor of Miss...
Oh, no. Are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, you just totally... You totally cut out.
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, no, we picked The Net and Dead Man by coincidence. We went with The Net first because we wanted to celebrate Sandra Bullock having just won her Oscar, and it was just by coincidence it's also 1995. You, before we started the show, you mentioned that some stuff has happened to her since then, and I wasn't aware of that. Could you enlighten me?
I will briefly go through it. Sandra Bullock is now getting a divorce from her husband, who's James Jesse, or Jesse James, a Harley Davidson enthusiast who had a TV show, and they're breaking up because he's been having an affair with a white supremacist fetish model. And there's been a lot of questioning. I haven't seen it anywhere. I was actually talking to my wife about it, and I'm like, you know what? I'll believe that Sandra Bullock didn't know this guy had a lot of white supremacist friends when she's on Oprah. And Oprah believes her. But until then, I find this really suspect. You know, people came out and defended Mel Gibson, of all people, right? Uh-huh, nobody's come out and said, I know Sandra Bullock didn't know he was a white supremacist. I haven't seen that yet. So her Academy Award-winning turn in The Blind Side, which is about her inspiring tale of shepherding a young black man into the NFL, is sort of being overshadowed by her divorce from a white supremacist.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's
kind of like how in The Net, she doesn't know that Jeremy Northam is actually a spy for the online security company that's trying to kill her.
There you go.
Her identity.
It's like The Net.
So life imitates art.
And
using the term art loosely.
The funny thing about Jeremy Northam being in it is we just saw him in Gosford Park.
Yeah, as he's really good in Gosford Park. He's really, really bad in this.
Yeah, and this was his first.
It's like, can't an English actor be in an action movie without having to be the villain, or just having a European accent pretty pretty much guarantee that you're going to be a villain if you're in some type of thriller or action movie.
Okay, so
this isn't an action movie. It's just a dopey thriller. But I sort of enjoyed this as a bad movie because I like dumb movies that think they're smart, and this movie definitely thinks it's smart because it's about the internet, and it's not that it gets so much about the internet wrong. It's just that like the internet is such a flimsy, superficial excuse for, you know, a woman on the run kind of movie. It's just the MacGuffin, as they say.
Well, it's it reminded me. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh well, I mean, more literally, she's got like a computer disc that's valuable at first, and people are trying to kill her to get it, and then it gets damaged. But you know, she knows the secret, so then they're trying to kill her. What were you gonna say?
Well, I was just gonna say that more than it being like a techno action movie, it's really just sort of an attempt at a John Grisham thriller type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It really feels like that.
It opens with a senator committing suicide. Just very Grishamy.
Yeah, that's a very Grishamy moment, and it's an idiot, and it actually makes really light of the. This was still 95. This was pre, you know, AIDS cocktail and stuff. This was when Chris Rock joked about somebody's AIDS flaring up was not funny.
Yeah,
and so this is their big thing is he's got AIDS. Funny.
Yeah, but it's fun. It's funny because it's insensitive, but it. They say that the reason that the senator killed himself because he thought he had AIDS was because he is a homophobe, and they use that word homophobe. So they're not exploiting AIDS. They're making a comment about homophobic United States senators who are also suicidal.
And the thing is that it's 95. Like, if that, you know, John Grisham at least would have come up with that. There would have been some reason for this that couldn't be easily explained by a blood transfusion, right? Now, The Net was directed by Irwin Winkler, who produced Rocky, and he produced Rocky and Goodfellas, and so, you know, kind of before I ever saw... Well, he also produced... I mean, he produced some other stuff, too, like... The Right Stuff. I mean, that was a big movie. And then he started directing.
The New Centurions. Oh, hey, and they shoot horses, don't they? Which we've watched on the show.
And then he...
is a great movie.
Yeah, and then he sort of became this really shitty director in the 90s.
Yeah.
And, look, he was one of the guys who tried to exploit... he tried to make the serious Iraq War movie before you won Academy Awards for it. But anyway, so he made Guilty by Suspicion, which I haven't seen, which I've heard is really bad. He made Night in the City, which is at the very least has some really good acting in it from a bunch of New York actors. And then he made The Net, which was, I think, Sandra Bullock's first starring role. I think it was before While You Were Sleeping. I'm not 100%.
Her first starring role after Speed.
After Speed, yeah. No, it looks like it came out after While You Were Sleeping. But this one was kind of a big deal because she opened it on her own or whatever.
Right. And
it was the start of her awesome career that ended for a while after Speed 2 and all that crap. And so, yeah, it's just like we had a hard time finding Sandra Bullock movies to watch because
it was either this or Speed 2. We wanted a bad one, and you know,
I like Speed 2. I wasn't going to watch
it. This or Speed 2, but you like Speed 2.
I'm not going to, you know, I like Speed 2 is it's fine. You know, it's as good as Iron Man. How's that?
All right. Well,
but I mean, I guess we could watch Crash, but I guess she wasn't in that enough. But so this one is interesting, too, because I forgot how mean it is. Because they kill off Dennis Miller. And
oh, yeah,
he
I wasn't expecting that.
Dennis Miller doesn't usually die in movies. Like, this was fine.
In the handful of movies that he was in the 90s, he didn't get killed. This might be the only one.
Didn't he die in the Tales from the Crypt, though?
Oh, right. That was like a twist ending. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's like.
In this, he died. In this, he's Sandra Bullock's psychologist, and in a really absurd plot contrivance, the reason that Sandra Bullock's identity is able to be erased is because she's supposedly such a computer techie that she never leaves the house, and Dennis Miller, as her therapist, is the one guy who like knows what she looks like and can give a visual ID. So they, you know, the conspiracy has to murder him too.
Yeah, and when we get into that no one in the world has seen what she looks like.
Her mother has Alzheimer's, so she doesn't remember her own daughter.
Yeah, it's.
It's really absurd, and I mean, talk about people in Dead Man looking too clean cut. She looks way too nice to be someone who's supposedly a shut in. I was kind of thinking, you know, this is kind of at the same time Janine Garofalo was trying to have a film career.
Mm-hmm.
And if Janine Garofalo started in this, it might have been good. Because then those scenes where Jeremy Northam is seducing her would have been like, hey, why is this really attractive guy going for Janine Garofalo? Something's fishy.
But yeah, I mean, the Jeremy. Well, there's also the suggestion that Jeremy Northam, there, at one point, he says that he really likes her, and that's why he had a hard time killing her.
Yeah.
But at the more amusing point earlier, he calls her a slut.
I forgot that.
And, I mean, it's a really harsh. I mean, in some ways, the beginning of the movie's almost. Well, it's not a good, because Winkler can't direct an action scene to save his life, so when it turns into a bunch of chase scenes, it's really painful. But.
Also, within the first, sorry.
No, go ahead. I can remember.
Well, I was just gonna say about the beginning that the movie destroys its techie credibility within the first 5 minutes by having Bullock supposedly beta testing a new computer game, which is Wolfenstein 3D, and came out a good 3 years before the net.
I don't think they ever worried about the net appealing to people who used computers. I mean, you know, obviously. But so the beginning is she goes on vacation right after her friend, who she's never met before, is going to fly up and see her and dies in this spectacular way because the evil Internet Protection Company. I mean, so basically, is Norton still big for the PC? If Norton was still big for the, is still big for the PC, or McAfee antivirus. They still have that, right? It's if McAfee the antivirus was trying to take over the world, basically.
Yeah, if it got the contract to do the United States computer networks security and was going to use that to take over the world.
It almost, I might be wrong, but isn't this story of the company creating the problem and then making people pay to pay them to fix
it. I know what you're saying. I'm not sure if it's so cliched and simple that it's, you know, it had to be in a few other movies, but
Batman it was in Batman Forever. That's what the Riddler and Two-Face were doing.
Yeah, that is kind of the same, which also came out in 95. So, but people were really afraid of technology in 1995.
And they were afraid
of how technology transforming our lives, and you know, Just as Batman Forever foresaw the dangers of 3D television, which we're about to have integrated into our lives, so too the net foresaw the dangers of having our identities completely available online and vulnerable to identity theft. I think this movie would make a lot more money if it came out now, because you know there's so many identity theft protection companies around now.
True,
bring on our fears of illegal aliens getting our social security numbers and stuff.
They should make it a sequel where it's the whole.
They did make a sequel.
Well, you know what I mean. No, the Nigerian bank fraud. They had to do a sequel.
Yeah, that would be great.
But no. Let me finish this one thing. I mean, I'm complimenting the net. This is the only time, you know.
Okay, please go ahead.
So after the absurd scene where her friend dies, that she's never met because they both only live on the computer. And let's forget that every tech guy in the world wants her because they all know she's a girl somehow, which doesn't make any sense. But anyway, because, you know, 1990, whatever.
1995 is like, wow, chat rooms.
Chat rooms and a girl's on the chat room. I bet she likes me. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's like, it's my girlfriend at Niagara Falls. To throw a obscure John Hughes thing in there that I'm, guess I'm embarrassed to know. When they get to the actual resort, the way it works is the way it's structured is that she has like this day with Jeremy Northam. I think it's only a day where she, you know, hangs out with him on vacation, and it's believable because she's on vacation. She's in the middle of nowhere. And then, you know,
Jeremy Northam introduces himself also as a hacker.
Yeah, he's very techie. He's got his laptop.
He's got a laptop on a beach back when that was a big deal and only nerds did that.
Yeah, and let's not forget that, you know, what I find so funny about Jeremy Northam being the stud in this, besides his really funny hair that I hope people give him, I hope his kids mock or something, because he's got this really funny haircut. He actually has almost the exact same haircut as Johnny Depp does in Dead Man. But anyway, the British guy being, like, sexy, I mean, really?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of thing Antonio Banderas would be doing in a year. Like, the British guy being, you know, it's like, what's the line from that, there's, you know, the British bad teeth and freckles. I mean, it's just, it's kind of funny that he plays the heartthrob in this. And this was his first American role, too. And I mean, like, it took him a while to recover from this. But anyway... So when she spends the day with him, it's believable, and is what I'm saying, that, you know, this sort of development is believable.
Yeah, actually, now that you mention it, yeah.
And so it's sort of unfortunate that they totally flush it right away.
Yeah, you sort of wish that he could have been her protector instead of her pursuer.
Or at least there was a twist ending. I mean, this is before any attempt at a twist ending in every movie. I mean, you know, twist endings being the 1990
de rigueur of the day.
Yeah, I mean, this being before that. So he reveals himself as the villain, and then she knows that he's the villain. How does she know he's the villain?
Oh, it's really stupid. They're on a boat, and she finds his gun that he's going to use to kill her. And he's like, oh, yeah, use that to hunt sharks. And, you know, I think she gives him the gun, and then he tries to shoot her, and she's like, oh, I got the bullets.
But she knows how to unload the gun because she's from Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm like, but your whole family lives in L.A. now. I mean, where's the development of that, that you took your senile mother with you to L.A.? I mean, it's a really bad L.A. movie, too, because they go to the Santa Monica Pier, but I think that's the only L.A. landmark in the movie.
Yeah, it is.
And this is from 95, and I think that in this point in time, LA landmarks were very big in movies. You had Falling Down, went through a lot of them. Lethal Weapon 3.
Speed is LA showcase.
Last Action Hero. I mean, like, LA was showcased.
Escape from LA was going to come out the next year.
I mean, it was, you know, at this point in time, L.A. was, you know, in the sort of movie vernacular that you knew everything about L.A. And they don't use it at all, and then they clearly shot it there. I mean, or maybe they didn't.
No, they did.
Well, I mean, maybe they shot some of it there, but did they shoot some of it up north?
possibly.
I'm looking that up, but let's get on to how Dennis Miller almost saves the movie. No, they filmed it entirely in L.A. Wow.
Yeah.
And some of it in Spain. Well, they filmed some of it in San Francisco. This is the last... I just want to mention this, is that they film it in the Moscone Center. And if you're sort of a Mac geek now, that's where they have all their Apple keynotes, or they used to. They don't anymore because Apple doesn't do those.
The big climactic ending.
The big climactic ending is there, and it's
which also before she runs into the building, pursued by Northam. There's like this really gratuitous healthcare protest march in the streets going on for no reason, and all the people marching look like they'd rather be anywhere else. It's kind of weird, kind of a weird coincidence.
I think that they just, I noticed that too, and I'm like, really? Healthcare? And it's like, they just couldn't think of anything else to have a protest going on for, I think. I mean, it's like kind of a parade scene if you don't set it around a holiday. It's like The Fugitive is set around St. Patrick's Day, so you can have the St. Patrick's Day parade. You can have throwaway dialogue about coloring the river green. If you don't have a parade, you've got to come up with a protest. And 95, I mean, it's a stretch, but I guess you could conceivably have...
It just seemed gratuitous because it's not even like... I guess they just needed it so that she could run through the streets and not get shot. But whatever, it's pretty... I mean, they should have... Winkler could have directed those extras a whole lot better. They all look really bored.
Well, Winkler is a really bad director. I mean, like, we say that a lot.
He really is. The opening scene with where the senator commits suicide is so cheesy because after he shoots himself, there's this big crane shot that lifts up and you see this statue in the background and you can just hear Irwin Winkler going like, wow, this is so cool, you know. People are gonna see this shot and they're gonna be like, wow.
I mean,
so epic.
We talk a lot about bad directors, but really, I mean, Winkler's the guy's
he's about as middlebrow as you can possibly be.
I mean, he's not even interestingly lame. He's kind of like
If a robot directed a movie, it would look like this.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, yeah.
if you created a computer program to direct a movie, it would be Irwin Winkler.
I mean, you know, it would do
the job, but it would also be sort of devoid of human human nuance, and occasionally it would do something that a computer program would try to do to titillate a human, like a crane shot.
Yeah. Now, okay, so here would be my only comparison. Is The Net as well directed as Congo is how bad I would say Irwin Winkler's direction is. He's like
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I would say it's worse because
I was gonna say that too. Yeah. And Congo's really badly directed. I'm looking through the list of our stuff and I'm like, Congo's definitely, you know, nowhere near as well directed as Last Boy Scout. I mean, really? Last Boy Scout had like Tintin
Cobra from last week.
Yeah, well, Cobra had those cool shots of Stallone in the sunglasses and trying to make Stallone look tall. This doesn't have anything like that. Yeah. I mean, he's really incompetent, and it's just like, that's what this movie is. As I was watching it, I was just kind of like, they're trying to do a John Grisham without, because John Grisham had never done, I don't know if he's done today, a techno thriller. It's a techno thriller that really is just a legal thriller, but it's a legal thriller in the John Grisham sense. So it's
It's like somewhere between Grisham and Tom Clancy and the keeping helping of boring.
Yeah. Now, okay, so speaking of actual good things in the movie, I don't know if I'd say Dennis Miller is good, but he had the opportunity to be really good.
Well, I was sort of hoping he would be in the rest of the movie just to make little
wisecracks.
But the movie really could have used him.
So his character is a therapist who sleeps with his clients, basically.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, already he's a stand-up guy, but it's that smarmy sort of Miller thing going on, and it works, and it's funny, and you know.
Yeah. Listen, babe, this internet thing makes Telex look like the Univac, okay?
The funniest thing is all this shit's happening to her, and he doesn't believe her for like 20 minutes of the movie. That was my favorite thing. He's like, you know, I believe you think people are after you, and I'll help you, but you know, come on here. Yeah. What are you even talking about, this internet thing? Come on.
Yeah, there's no such thing as the internet. What are you talking about?
I guess if we were going to have talked about all the internet stuff.
Well, there's a couple of real funny things. I mean, you know, this movie came out the same year as Hackers, which is just like the ultimate tech ignorant techno thriller, cyberpunk cash-in movie for youth. But you know, this isn't anywhere near as outrageous as that. But there are a couple of really funny things, like at the beginning when Bullock is getting seduced by Northrum over the chat room. Seems to be the world's only chat room where people's text messages are read aloud in some horrible garbled robot voice through your computer speakers.
Do you think they did? That wasn't dramatic license, was it? I mean, that was really the computer talking to her, or was it was? Okay.
I don't think it was in her head. I think it was like you said about Wolfenstein. It was for the benefit of people who don't usually use computers.
All right.
But it was, you know, it was really silly. And you know, aside from the whole Bullock not looking like a computer user in any way thing, I don't know. There's like the conclusion at the computer center where, you know, everything is riding on copying stuff from one three-quarter inch diskette to another, and it's sort of like you're witnessing the birth of the movie cliche of like people huddled over computers being really, you know, I guess that started with Jurassic Park a couple of years earlier, but I mean, Steven Spielberg had the good sense to make what was happening on the computers visually interesting. But this is sort of like the birth of thrillers where people sit around the computer waiting for stuff to load, and it's supposed to be really exciting.
Yeah,
maybe nostalgic for those old hard disks, the old fashioned technology.
Yeah, that is a good question. If somebody watches the net today, if like a 12-year-old watches the net today, can they understand, you know, all the?
You'd have to tell them like, well, see, before we had flash drives, we had 3/4-inch diskettes.
Yeah, but how would you ever explain? Do you remember what were they called? Zip disks.
Disks. Yeah, the intermediary.
This
was made even before that.
Yeah. So I mean, there's stuff like that. There's what else?
Oh, you know, it was hilarious. When she logs on to the website that she's supposed to be debugging and troubleshooting. It's a website for a band called Mozart's Ghost, and when you go onto this website, you hear this dude tacular voice go, Mozart's Ghost, whoa! and that's one of the most amusing things in the movie.
Yeah, it's that kind of understanding of the internet. I think that it's
an early web page. Yeah. Internet. Movies about the internet.
Do they still make? They still made these throughout the 90s.
Right. I think The Matrix was kind of the end of it, actually, because that was where it was like, you know, let's just use the. Everybody knows what the internet is. Let's just use that as the launching pad for other stuff. But up till then, you still had, like, you know, You've Got Mail, which is a remake of The Shop Around the Corner, but with AOL product placement.
Right, but I think, don't they use AOL in it, at least? I mean, The Matrix still follows that wonderful sort of the fake computer thing that they always have going on of, they don't really have Windows,
they've got a generic OS.
Yeah, they got a generic OS with a lot of graphics, with big type and stuff like that. And
uses Macs in this movie. I mean, they're not. It's interesting because it's not. I don't think Apple paid for the product placement in this movie. I mean, you can Apple pays for product placement in so many movies that you always notice the Apple logo in the movies that they've paid for. But in this one, it's just like. Yeah, she's using PowerPCs, and they're not featuring the logos or anything. It's not a commercial for Macs because they don't want you to think that, you know, owning a Mac is going to make you more susceptible to international conspiracies.
And it even would have made you less susceptible, and still would. So, you know, that would have been a wonderful slander lawsuit or whatever. But
Do you think that the head of the company who's behind the conspiracy is supposed to be like a Bill Gates stand-in in a way. Because
I was thinking
it's like something that they could have done if they gave a crap about about computers, if computers weren't just a cipher for the movie.
No, see, my problem is this is 95.
Mm-hmm.
So you were just having the Windows 95 thing going on. Bill Gates hadn't yet been sort of demonized as making a really lame operating system, because in the general, you know, it wasn't like there was Mac at this point. This is 4 years before even that first iMac, right? And people would have known who Bill Gates was, but he wasn't. I mean, he was a goofy, nerdy guy. Maybe he had the Simpsons thing, but he wasn't a good villain. And I think if they had made Bill Gates the bad guy, it would have been a lot funnier. It would have been, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's an interesting idea. What if the most popular operating system in the world is really spying on you so they can do stupid shit like mess up Sandra Bullock's life?
You know what's funny in the movie is like... I mean, about it sort of being a movie about identity theft, like 15 years too early. It's like some of the technology wasn't, I'm pretty sure it wasn't there at the time the movie was made that we have now that would make the plot possible. Like when Miller's been poisoned, basically, and he's at a hospital, and Bullock is talking to the receptionist, and she's like, you know, don't you have, my doctor here? And she's like, you know, I don't know. The computer says he's not here. And right. She's like, damn you computers, you maniacs. And then she like throws the monitor on the floor, and Erwin Winkler lets the camera linger on it as some kind of statement. But it's just as idiotic as, like, nobody's seen Sandra Bullock outside of her house. Like, what, nobody saw Dennis Miller get wheeled to the hospital? Nobody knows what he looks like? Nobody checked his driver's license? Like, they're only relying on the computers to... And also, like, how did the conspiracy, you know, access the hospital computers? Oh, just because, you know... Every computer in the world is linked up in 1995.
Yeah, and that's a really funny idea because, you know, as I remember in 1995, you had to dial up on your modem and you had to...
Yeah, we're still talking the days of 56K here.
95? Are you... I think you were 28.8, man. 56K was highbrow. That was geeky, man. That was techie. This is like...
Okay. Yeah,
you know, you want to download a song from iTunes, it's going to take about, you know, 20 minutes.
You have to wait until iTunes is invented.
Well, it kind of reminds me of this is just a very broad, computers are dangerous and can, you know, bad things can happen with computers. And the movie was sold as an identity theft movie. There were all sorts of...
The tagline is like, you know, what happens when your life is erased or deleted?
And that's...
They're going to delete your life.
And that's barely in it, really. I mean, like, such a long... It's like 35 minutes before Jeremy Northam's revealed as a bad guy. It's a long movie. I mean, I remember you said that. It's like 2 hours.
Yeah, it's 2 hours.
But it's like that, what was that movie? The Ben Affleck, Tom Clancy one. Some of All Fears.
Yeah.
I actually did not see all of Some of All Fears. I had, when I went to go see it in the theater, I had a more pressing engagement of leaving the theater than sitting through it. So I got my golden ticket for the next thing to walk out of and left. But a friend of mine was telling me that all the terrorists use email, and it was like, ooh, we got to watch that email because the terrorists use it. And this was, of course, in 2002. So it was, and it's like, that's at least specialized, right? This is just everything on the internet's bad. Everything on the internet's dangerous. It's, this is like AOL should have, you know, put some money into this so they could be like, but what you could do is use AOL. Because we don't get on the internet, you know, like AOL.
We don't try to kill you.
Well, didn't AOL take like 3 years to get onto the internet once the internet got to be a big thing? I don't know. I can't remember, but
yeah.
90s sort of online trivia, online networking trivia. I mean, it's just like, and that's one of those things that I think
I love the parts of this movie that made me nostalgic for 90s technology, and there wasn't enough of it.
Well, they couldn't have known that it was going to go away.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to wonder if Erwin Winkler thought the whole internet thing was just a fad. Speaking of the words, the internet, I like that in Japan, that is the title of this movie, simply The Internet. The net, though, that's, you know, that's hip.
Wasn't 95 also the year that Johnny Mnemonic came out?
Hey, you're right. Wow, cyberpunk.
Uh-oh, the cat just came into the room again.
Just tiptoed across the floor. Well, what else is there to say about the net? You know how the last shot has, you know, a mouse, a cursor,
yeah,
slides mm-hmm. across the screen and clicks something.
Yeah.
If Erwin Winkler knew what he was doing, he should have ripped off the last shot from Tron, where the camera pans out above the city and all the city lights look like a circuit board.
But, dude, in Tron, that was totally a metaphor for how the computer was alive too. The net didn't have that ideological thing going on.
Oh, right, yeah. Tron had more ideas than the net.
Tron is a lot better directed than the net. Tron's got
I mean it's sort of apples and oranges except for the computers.
But just in terms of bad movies that are better directed than that. Mark Isham's music for the net really sucks, like to the point that
I looked up his name. How do you even notice it?
It pissed me off at some point. I'm like, what idiot did this music? And I'm like, oh, Mark Isham? He's usually okay.
It's just as generic as Winkler's direction.
And this was a reasonable hit. It got Sandra Bullock more money for her next movie. It, you know.
Yeah. Well, we should also mention before we end that it was popular enough to spawn a short-lived TV series.
Well.
and in an amazing act of nepotism, The Net 2.0, which was made about 10 years later, direct-to-video, was directed by Erwin Winkler's son.
Who actually is a better director than his father, based on the movie he made in New Orleans. But, hold on. When was the sequel made?
It was like 2005 or something. Or 2004. Or
I'm sorry, not the sequel. The TV show.
Oh. Because shortly thereafter.
It is from Sony. And of anybody... I mean, the net was 3 years later. There was the short-lived TV show.
Oh, yeah, it was 3 years later. Oh, and it's the same character, actually, being reprised.
But Sony exploited their properties, I guess I'd say, earlier than anybody else really did. I mean, Universal tried it with all their direct-to-video sequels and TV movie sequels around the same time. But Sony sort of... You know, Sony's always been into exploiting knockoffs of theatrical releases. I mean, you know, Starship Troopers, the sequel was actually hijacked by the guys who Sony was going to make it, and the guys who worked on the first one wanted to be involved, and so they sort of got Sony to agree to let them do it, but Sony would have made it anyway. Like, there have been seven Wild Things movies or whatever, you know, like...
Oh, right, right.
Or Cruel
right.
Intentions 6 through 9 and shit like that, but...
Yeah.
We gotta mention, because I think we've mentioned him before, Roger Ebert likes this movie.
Yeah, and he gave Dead Man 1.5 stars.
Roger Ebert likes this movie almost as much as he likes Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And this is the thing is, you know, growing up in Chicago, there's people love Ebert there, and it's inexplicable how anybody could love a guy who loves this, who even, you know, would tell you not to run out of, you know, the ticket line screaming at the thought of seeing this. But it's funny because on Wikipedia, they say Nobody liked it except Robert J. Ebert, which I found amusing.
Fact, yeah. I see the Net TV series had enough episodes to do a Y2K episode. That must have been interesting.
I think they were just early, right? Because it only lasted a... Is it out on DVD?
It is Region 2, if you're interested.
You know what? Tim Curry was in it. Wow.
It apparently has some nice guest stars here. Jeffrey Combs, The Rock. and that's it. So, yeah. Well.
Oh, wait. Hold on. Net 2.0 had... is this the guy I think it is? Hold on, I'm going back in his... Wow, okay. We have our symmetry now. The what? Net TV show had a guest star or something from, I don't know how to pronounce his name, Jesu Garcia, who was once known as Nick Corey. And for the listeners, yes, this is all going to lead up to something. Who was in... Nightmare on Elm Street as Rod, and we're starting our run up to the Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Yeah, let's plug that now.
Yeah.
The episode after next, just in time for the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, is going to be our Nightmare on Elm Street special. Basically, because people seem to love the one we did on part two. Freddy's Gay Revenge. So we're going to do probably one of the worst movies in the series, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, and then the one that came out just 3 years after The Final Nightmare, New Nightmare, which was Craven's return to the series, and it's a really cool kind of postmodern horror movie. Before he did Scream, this was his postmodern horror movie before Scream. But first, we are going to do for our next episode Watchmen, and not just the theatrical cut or the director's cut, but some new super duper extra long cut that came out with all the Tales of the Black Freighter comic book stuff interspersed in it. I guess
I believe that is narrated by Jared Butler, who is
Gerard Butler?
Whatever his name is. One of the worst actors in the world, and so hearing him narrate the comic book will be interesting.
Uh-huh. Well, but that's Zack Snyder for you.
Yeah, we picked that because Jackie Earle Haley is going to be the new Freddy Krueger, so it's all like this huge lead-up to Nightmare on Elm Street, which I guess...
It's all connected, man.
I guess I should probably see it now, the remake, huh?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I mean, I'll be fine if I never see the Friday the 13th remake, and I still regret to this day seeing the Texas Chainsaw remake, but I'll give Nightmare on Elm Street a shot. Not in the theater, but, you know, eventually.
It at least has a screenwriter that people have heard of, right? It's Wesley Strick, isn't it?
Yeah, who's probably a better screenwriter than... what am I saying? It's going to suck, but, I mean, I'll see it.
Didn't Wesley Strick write one of the Batman movies for?
No, he did some touch up stuff on Batman Returns, and Daniel Waters likes to say that he was responsible for everything in the script that wasn't good, like Alfred suggesting that they watch The Love Connection.
That just makes me wonder why I ever. All right, we're getting way off with Wesley Strick discussion, but anyway, so next week is Watchmen. It's the director's cut's 3 hours. The special edition has got to be at least 3:30. You've seen it before, right?
Yeah, I know. I saw it, and I never thought I'd see it again. But
it's got the greatest love scene ever in a movie. Come on, now.
It's going to be one big piece of crap, but...
And we're going to dedicate an hour to it, so maybe actually next time we should come up with some sort of agenda for the episode so we don't get way too off track talking about how good... all right, that was just a joke. I could probably talk for 12 minutes about how shitty Matthew Good's performance is, so we're going to have to keep on target.
It's an epic. There's a lot to talk about. So that's next episode. So join us, won't you? And this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. Check out our site, alansmithypodcast.info. I have been Matt.
And I've been Andrew.
And thanks for listening. Turn a wider shade of pain.